Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Computer History Museum. I'm John Holler, the CEO, and it's my pleasure to welcome you tonight on behalf of our trustees, our staff, our members, our amazing volunteers, all the people involved in making the museum a great place. Thank you. Thank you for being here tonight for the kickoff of our Revolutionaries Speaker Series for 2013. We have major funding for the Revolutionary Speaker Series from Intel. We're delighted to have Intel's support for the fourth year running now, and it's fantastic because it enables everything that we do to make these Revolutionaries programs possible. We also get additional funding from the William K. Bose Foundation. I want to say a special thank you to Tesla for arranging to have a Model S here this evening. I hope you had a chance to see the Model S downstairs. We've been looking forward for years to an event when we could have the Motor Trend Car of the Year at the museum. And we have it here tonight, so thank you to Tesla. We asked SpaceX for a rocket. That proved to be a little more challenging, but maybe someday. And now for tonight's program. Here's a thought exercise. If you compiled a list of the 75 most influential people of the 20th century, who would be on your list? Or if you compile perhaps a list of the 100 people who most affected the world in the 20th century, who would be on that list? Now, think of the same list that you might start compiling for the 21st century so far. And if all of that proves to be a little too much, I can offer some help. Elon Musk has been on every single one of those lists that has been compiled for the 20th century to date, no matter who seems to be drawing the lists up. Few scientists, entrepreneurs, or industrialists of the last century could stake a claim to a career as boldly ambitious as the one Elon Musk is fashioning now. Transforming a large measure of the world's commerce and payment systems as co-founder and chairman of PayPal in 1999 might be enough for anyone for one lifetime. But Elon Musk has gone on from there to pursue his passion for solving business, environmental, and scientific problems on a global scale. He may be best known for his work at Tesla, where he serves as CEO and head of product design. The path-breaking Tesla Roadster and now the Model S have changed almost all of the assumptions that the automotive world has made about what the styling, performance, and future of a new generation of electric cars might be. Simultaneously, he serves as chairman and principal shareholder of SolarCity, the nation's leading provider of solar power systems. But perhaps his most ambitious and intriguing work is taking place at SpaceX, where he is CEO and chief designer. SpaceX is erasing the boundaries between spaceflight and private enterprise. It has a multi-billion dollar, multi-year agreement with NASA to be a workhorse for cargo flights to and from the International Space Station. And in 2015, that is the company's stated goal. It will begin manned spaceflight. What is the source of Elon Musk's revolutionary thinking? How has he been able to do what he's done with the investors he's attracted and the teams that he's built? Exploring these questions and more tonight with Elon is Allison Van Diggelen, who is a very notable and noteworthy journalist here in Silicon Valley, a contributor to KQED and the Huffington Post, and one of the best interviewers in the field through her series, Fresh Dialogues. We're delighted to have Allison here tonight. This is her first time on stage. She's going to be terrific, as will Elon. Please join me in welcoming Elon Musk and Allison Van Diggelen.
So I'd like to start. You grew up in South Africa. Right. And I heard a wonderful story of when you were 6 years old, and you started breaking the rules even then. So you were 6 years old, and you were invited by your cousin to a birthday party. But there were two problems with that. One, you were grounded. And two, it was on the other side of town. Yeah. So can you explain, tell the audience how you got there?
All right. Well, I mean, this was when I was six, so the memory's a little fuzzy at this point. as I recall, I was grounded for some reason. I don't know why, but I think I felt that was unjust. and I really wanted to go to this party, my cousin's party. Who was five, you know, so this isn't a kid's party, but, at first I was going to take my bike, but then, and I told my mom this, which is a mistake, And she told me some story about how you needed a license for a bike, and the police would stop me. So I wasn't 100% sure if that was true or not, but I thought I'd better walk just in case. I sort of thought I knew the way, but it was clear across town. So I don't know, it was 10 or 12 miles away. It's really, really quite far, further than I realized, actually. So I just started walking to my cousin's house. I think it took me about 4 hours. And just as my mom was leaving that party with my brother and sister, she saw me walking down the road and freaked out. And then she saw me, so I then sprinted to my cousin's house, and I was just about two blocks away, and then climbed a tree and refused to come down.
Wow. So the first of many rule-breaking adventures Musk. So by the time you were 12, you were already an entrepreneur and making a profit. I understand you earned $500 equivalent in Rand for creating a video game. Can you tell us about that and what the inspiration was?
When I was about 10, I walked into a computer store in South Africa and saw an actual computer. I previously had some early sort of precursors to the Atari system, and then I got the Atari system, which I'm sure a lot of people here have played. But then I saw you could actually have a computer where you could make your own games, and it was a Commodore VIC-20. So it was the first computer I bought, and then I got some books on how to teach yourself programming, and this was like the coolest thing I'd ever seen. So I was just like, this is super awesome. So I started programming games and then selling games in order to actually buy more games. So a bit of a circular thing. And more games and better computers and that kind of thing.
So the money wasn't the end goal for you. It was more a means to an end.
Basically, I'd spend money on better computers and Dungeons and Dragons modules and things like that. Nerdmaster 3000, basically.
So I understand at that time you were heavily into comics. I'm curious to know, did you love Iron Man, the comic Iron Man?
I did kind of like Iron Man, yeah.
You did?
Well, it was good.
Did you ever imagine that you would be the inspiration for the movie version?
I did not. Yes. No. That was pretty much... I would say 0%. I would have said 0% chance.
What kind of kid were you? I mean, can you look back and see yourself? Were you a bit of a loner kid, bookish kid?
I wasn't all that much of a loner. At least not willingly. But I certainly was I was very very bookish. I was reading all the time. So I was either reading, working on my computer, reading comics, playing Dungeons and Dragons. That kind of thing.
And I understand Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, that wonderful book by Douglas Adams. That was a key book for you. What was it about that book that fired your imagination?
I guess when I was around 12 or 13, I had kind of an existential crisis, and I was reading various books on trying to figure out the meaning of life and what does it all mean? Because it's seeming quite meaningless, and then we happen to have like some books by Nietzsche and Schopenhauer in the house, which you should not read at age 14. It's bad. It's really negative. But then I read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which was like quite positive, I think, and it sort of highlighted the an important point, which is that a lot of times the question is harder than the answer. And if you can properly phrase the question, then the answer is the easy part. To the degree that we can better understand the universe, then we better know what questions to ask. And then whatever the question is that most approximates what's the meaning of life, that's the question we could ultimately get closer to understanding. I thought, well, to the degree that we can expand the scope and scale of consciousness and knowledge, human knowledge, then that would be a good thing.
Wow, so you were having these deep thoughts at what age, 10, 14?
Yeah, sort of in the puberty, I guess. I was 13 through 15, probably the most traumatic years.
Right, and so by the time you were 17, you were actually left, right? I assume you hatched the plan earlier when you were around 14, 15?
I did hatch the plan earlier. Actually, I tried to hatch several plans, which they did not hatch.
Right. But by 17, you were on a plane from South Africa.
Yeah.
You'd had enough of South Africa. You were ready to seek new pastures. Now, why was it the United States was your destination? Why not Europe or somewhere else in the world?
Well, just whenever I'd read about cool technology, it would tend to be in the United States, you know, or more broadly North America, or including Canada. So I kind of wanted to be where the cutting edge of technology was. And of course, within the United States, Silicon Valley is where the heart of things are, is. So, although at the time I didn't know where Silicon Valley was, it sounded like some mythical place.
Really? That's great.
So I wanted to come to the U.S. I tried to convince my mother or father who were divorced, if either one of them would move to the United States, then I could get there. At one point, I convinced my father, but then he reneged, unfortunately.
So you had him convinced, and then he changed his mind?
He did say yes, and then he changed his mind.
Why?
I don't know. I guess he was fairly established. He's an engineer. He's sort of established in South Africa and didn't want to have to go through that again in another country.
Right. So you got on that plane all by yourself at 17?
My mother was born in Canada, and actually her father was American. But unfortunately, she didn't get her American citizenship, so then that broke the link, and I couldn't get my American citizenship. But she was born in Canada, so I could get. I actually filled out the forms for her and got her a Canadian passport and me too. And then, as soon as within 3 weeks of getting my Canadian passport, I was in Canada.
Right, and then you ended up at the University of Pennsylvania.
Yeah,
you did a degree in physics and business.
Yeah, so I was in Canada for a few years at Queen's University, got a scholarship to go down to University of Pennsylvania, because one of the downsides of coming to University of North America was that my parents said they would not pay for college if it was, or my father said he would not pay for college unless it was in South Africa. So it was either, so I could have free college in South Africa or find some way to pay it here, and fortunately I got a scholarship at UPenn. And so did dual undergraduate business and physics at UPenn Wharton.
Right. And it was there that you came up with this idea of three main areas that you felt were most important to humanity. Can you describe how you came upon them? Was it just one day you had a flash of inspiration, these are the three areas that are important and I want to concentrate on? Or how did that inspiration come to you?
No, I think I was thinking about it for a couple of years. And during sort of freshman and sophomore year at Queens, and then also at UPenn, and I was trying to think what would most influence the future. You know, what are the problems that we have to solve? And I actually talked a lot to friends and my housemates and that kind of thing, and dates, which was maybe not the best thing. So, yeah. Actually met a woman I dated briefly in college, who now works at Scientific American as a writer, and she related the anecdote that we went on a date. I was talking about was electric cars. That was not a winning conversation.
So it was a bit of a monologue, was it?
Yeah, she said she said the first question I asked her was, "Do you ever think about electric cars?" No, she so never does.
So you learn from that. That wasn't the best shout-out line.
Wasn't great.
But
it has recently it's been more effective.
There you go. An honest man. Yeah. That's wonderful. Well, we'll get on to Tesla soon. But I want to go from University of Pennsylvania. You ended up in Silicon Valley. And you've described Silicon Valley as Darwinian. Can you talk about what it was?
In the most positive sense, really.
In the most positive sense. I mean, it's not, yeah. Can you elaborate on what that means and why it had to be Silicon Valley? What drew you to Silicon Valley?
I was at Penn, and there was a professor who was chairman of a company in Silicon Valley that was working on advanced capacitors for use in electric cars, or potentially for use in electric cars. As it turns out, they're way too expensive. But I thought, well, this is really awesome, because then I asked if I could get a summer job, because it was in Silicon Valley and working on technology for electric cars. I thought, well, that's pretty much as good as it gets. So I got a summer job here. It was in Los Gatos, actually, at Pinnacle Research, doing electrolytic ultracapacitors, which were. The problem was that they used a ruthenium tantalum oxide, and there was, I think, only a few tons of ruthenium mined in the world, so not very scalable. Mm. And that, you know, they'd sell it to you by the sort of milligram. So, you know, there's a problem. But it had a pretty high energy density. It's sort of roughly equivalent to a lead acid battery, which for a capacitor is huge.
Mm-hmm. But you ended up then after that at Stanford?
Yeah, so then I thought Stanford is in Silicon Valley, sort of epicenter, and so that's where I wanted to come. Either Stanford or Berkeley, and Stanford's sort of sunnier, so I liked it.
Sunnier, that's good. And I understand you were at Stanford University for a whole 2 days before you decided, no, it's time, I'm going to do my first startup.
Yeah, I figured, so this was the summer of 95, and I'd been working on some internet software. So, because the three things I thought would affect the world were the internet, sustainable energy, and space exploration, making life multiplanetary. So, but on the internet thing, I just couldn't figure out how to make enough money to feed myself. You know, because if I didn't make money, then I would like run out of food and die. So that was not good.
So basic needs.
So,
right.
Yeah, literally. If I was a student, then I could be a teaching assistant and do various things and do research on. Electric vehicle technologies. That was my default plan. But then I also thought that if I did a PhD at Stanford, then I would spend several years watching the internet go through this incredibly rapid growth phase, and that would be really difficult to handle. Like, it's like you really wanted to be doing something.
So you saw the wave growing.
Yeah, it sort of really seemed like things were going to take off. Although nobody had made any money on the internet at the time. In 95, there was really nobody was making any money on the internet. And in fact, even on Sand Hill Road, people were like, what's the internet? They were amazingly, when we tried to get funding for a company, and I think it was November or something of 95, there about October, November, more than half of the venture capitalists we met with did not know what the internet was and had not used it.
That's amazing.
Yeah, literally. I'm like, it's like, isn't that, they were literally asking, isn't that something that the government and universities use? I'm like, for now. but, you know. But then Netscape went public in late 95, I think it was, and then after that, even though a lot of venture capitalists still didn't understand it and still hadn't used it, somebody had made money on it, so now that...
It was on the radar.
Yeah, so when we went to get funding, the second time we tried to get funding, everyone was interested.
Right, so this company was Zip2.
That's right.
And...
Terrible name.
Yeah, what was the reason for that name?
Well, we were just incredibly stupid at the time, I think. That's the main reason for that name. Because we got some ad agency, because we thought, well, we don't know anything about names, so we'll get some ad agencies to suggest a bunch of options, and then Zip2 seemed kind of speedy. I don't know why the hell we chose that stupid name. And it has a digit in it. It's like, why would you pick it? Because it could be Zip2. Could be Zip TWO, it could be Zip TOO. So, like, people like literally spelt the name every variation, mm-hmm. Which is bad if you go to URL and you don't have the other ones. So Zip2 started off as basically like I said, we're trying to figure out how to make enough money to exist as a company, and so since there wasn't really any advertising money being made, we thought we could help existing companies get online, bring their stuff online. So we developed software that helped bring a lot of the newspapers and media companies online, because a lot of them just didn't, they also didn't know what the internet was.
You had some big customers, didn't you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And even the ones that were aware of the internet didn't have a software team, so they weren't very good at developing functionality. So we had, as investors and customers, the New York Times Company, Knight Ridder, Hearst, mm-hmm. and so we were able to get them to pay us to develop software for them to bring them online, so online publishing stuff. And we did maps and directions and yellow pages and white pages and various other things. We developed quite sophisticated technology, actually, but it wasn't actually being employed super well by the media companies. Like we would suggest ways to use it, and then it would not be used as effectively as it could be. It was very frustrating.
Right, but you did sell that company successfully to Compaq.
Yeah.
Right, and that allowed you to go on and create X.com.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. So, Compaq had AltaVista. So their thought was to combine AltaVista and a bunch of other technology companies and see if that would work, which it did not. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, they were pretty nice guys and bought the company, and that gave me the capital to do another company. And I wanted to do another company in the internet because I thought we hadn't really reached the potential that we could have with Zip2. Because we had really sophisticated software. I mean, our software was sort of at least comparable to what Yahoo or Excite or others had. In fact, I mean, I thought in some ways it was better. So, but it wasn't, because it was all filtered through these partners, it wasn't getting properly used. So I thought, I want to do something that could be a more significant contribution to the internet. And and so the initial thought was financial services, because money is digital, it's low bandwidth. At the time, there was, you know, most people were on modems, still on modems, and because this was late 98, early 99.
So this was, X.com was a precursor to PayPal, basically.
That's right, yeah.
Right? You merged with Confinity, and it became PayPal, major success.
Yeah, so it worked out better than we expected. Confinity, initially Confinity and X.com started out from slightly different directions and then converged to the same point. With X, the thought was to create an integrated set of financial services so you could go to one place and do all of your financial anything. Mm-hmm. And then as a feature, we had the ability to transfer money or securities or anything simply by entering a unique identifier. So like a email address or phone number or something like that. But when we would demo the system, the hard stuff, which was the integration of all the financial services, people would not be interested in. But they'd be really interested in being able to transfer money using an email address. Right. Even though that was actually quite easy. And so we focused our energy on that. And although it's easy in principle, what gets really hard is adding security while still keeping it easy to use. You know, it's like the Willie Loman quote, like, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. So mm-hmm. why do people rob PayPal? Same reason.
Right.
So you can dial up the security to a really high level, but then you're going to make it very hard to use. That was one of the toughest things we wrestled with. And then Confinity originally started as kind of software for Palm Pilots. And then they had a demonstration application, which was the ability to beam money from one Palm Pilot to another using the infrared port. People remember that one.
Yes.
That was big at one point. And then they had a website sort of parallel to that, where you, because once you'd beamed the infrared tokens, you had to still then synchronize your Palm Pilot and do the transfer via the website. But then people weren't that interested in the Palm Pilot stuff, but they were interested in the website. So we kind of converged to the same point, and we're quite close together. So we decided to merge the companies in, I think, January or so of 2000. was a very turbulent period. and the growth in the company was pretty crazy. Mm-hmm. Like we had, at the end of the first sort of 4 or 5 weeks, we had 100,000 customers.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible growth. Did you anticipate that when you started out?
Definitely did not.
Right.
And it wasn't all good because we had some bugs in the software, and you know, even if the bug only occurs 1 in 1,000 times, it's still,
right,
if you have 100,000
like
customers,
that,
you have 100
yes.
very angry customers. Like, where's my money? That would be,
yes.
you know, a reasonable concern that people would have. And then we had customer service on University and Avenue in Palo Alto. There were 5 people. So when something went wrong, customer service phones would basically explode.
Oh, my goodness.
So we had many challenges, and then the various financial regulatory agencies were trying to shut us down. Visa and MasterCard were trying to shut us down. eBay was trying to shut us down. FTC was trying to shut us down. There were a lot of battles there.
Wow. Yeah. It's quite incredible with all that adversity you conquered. And you came out with several hundred million, right?
Yeah, it was a close call. We definitely, came very close to dying there in 2000 and 2001.
And what was the reason for that success? What would you put it down to in that case? How did you overcome?
I think we had a really talented group of people at PayPal, and a lot of those people have actually gone on to start many other companies.
Yes.
YouTube, LinkedIn, Yelp, mm-hmm. Yammer. It's like quite a long list, actually.
So for you personally, there you were with several hundred million. Were you not tempted just to go and buy an island?
Not really.
What was it that drove you? What I'm getting at, because I know you didn't.
But sure.
What I'm getting at is, why were you so driven to jump into the next thing?
Well, I was...
Did you take any time off?
I did take a bit of time off. Because after PayPal, I did reasonably well from PayPal. I was the largest shareholder in the company, and we were acquired for about $1.5 billion in stock, and then the stock doubled. So, did reasonably well. But the idea of like lying on a beach as my main thing, just sounds like the worst. That sounds horrible to me.
Mm-hmm. Just the boredom factor.
I would go bonkers. I would, I would have to be on serious drugs.
Or serious pina coladas.
Right, exactly. Right. I'd be super duper bored. I like high intensity. I like going to the beach for a short period of time, but not much longer than a few days or something like that.
Right. So let's talk about the seeds of SpaceX. I understand it started not as the idea of let's start a rocket ship company. You had a philanthropic idea. You were really surprised when you found out that NASA didn't have any plans to go to Mars. And you
yes.
came up with this idea of let's put a greenhouse on Mars. So can you explain how that whole idea came into being for SpaceX?
Sure. Well... So when I was thinking of what I thought would affect the world as a student, it wasn't really from the standpoint of those are the things I'll get involved in. It was kind of more in the abstract. These are the things I think will happen that will affect the world, but not that I will be involved in them. As it turns out, I have. But I always thought that we would make much more progress in space, and it just didn't happen. It was really disappointing. So. I was really quite bothered by it. Mm-hmm. When we went to the moon, we were supposed to have a base on the moon. We were supposed to send people to Mars, and that stuff just didn't happen. We went backwards. Mm-hmm. We got the space shuttle, but the space shuttle could only go to low Earth orbit, where Saturn V could go to the moon. Now the space shuttle's gone, and so that just seemed like a really bad thing. So. I thought, maybe it was a question of there not being enough attention or will to do this. But this was a wrong assumption. So, but that's the reason for the greenhouse idea. It was the thought was if there could be sort of a small philanthropic mission to Mars. You know, so I was expecting to lose all the money that I'd invested in that. But if we could send a small greenhouse to the surface of Mars with seeds in dehydrated nutrient gel, and you hydrated upon landing, and you'd have this great shot of, you know, little greenhouse with little green plants with on a red background, I thought that would get people excited.
So you literally imagined a photograph inspiring a new
generation?
Yeah,
you got to sort of imagine the money shot, if you will. I think you know, green plants and red background would be that. And people tend to get interested and excited about precedents and superlatives. So this would be the furthest that life's ever traveled, the first life on Mars, as far as we know. And I thought, well, maybe that would result in a bigger budget for NASA, and then we could sort of resume the journey. Mm-hmm. That was the basic idea. And I spent several months on this, actually, and went to Russia 3 times. Because I was able to figure out how to get the cost of the spacecraft low and the communications and the greenhouse and all that to a reasonable number, reasonable meaning several million dollars.
Did you actually physically draw out a greenhouse of how you imagined?
Yeah, I hope we got that somewhere.
That'd be amazing to see.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, I'm sure it looks pretty goofy in retrospect, but that's the idea that we had, and it. I spent several $100,000 just kind of getting the design worked out and engaging some companies to come up with the design specifications for the subsystems, but then it came to buying the rocket, and the problem was that the cost of rockets is really high, and the lowest cost rocket in the U.S. at the time was the Delta II, Boeing's Delta II, and that would have been about $50 million. And then you'd still need to have like an upper stage for Mars, so probably $60 million all in. And that was, and I wanted to do two of these missions because I thought if it did just one and it didn't work, then that could have the opposite effect. Like, look how dumb it is to do to try to save
Mars.
Right,
look at all this money down the drain.
Yeah,
right.
What an idiot. So I wanted to do two, and I just didn't have enough money to do two complete missions.
Right, so you had a budget of about $100 million, something like that.
Well, I was hoping it would be less than that, but not more. I mean, mm-hmm. not more than that. I guess roughly on that order is about the most I'd be. I couldn't spend much more than that.
So the Russians didn't help you out?
Yeah, three quite interesting trips to Russia to try to negotiate purchase of two Russian ICBMs. Mm-hmm. yeah.
And did they think you had evil intent?
No, they just thought I was crazy. but I mean, that's not good either, if you're buying ICBMs. But minus the nuke. I mean, I think that would have been a lot more.
So you didn't talk nukes to him?
No, I got the feeling that that was on the table, which was very alarming. Those were very weird meetings with the Russian military and whatnot. I mean, I think they thought I was a bit crazy, but then they read about PayPal and said, okay, he was crazy, but he's got money.
He did something right.
Yeah, well, and more importantly, I could pay them.
Right, yes.
It was remarkably capitalist was my impression.
Of the Russians.
Yeah.
Right. I have heard that before.
Yep.
So tell me, what was the turning point from, you know, talking with the Russians and then deciding, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to set up a company. What was that turning point for you?
Well, I came to the conclusion that my initial premise was wrong, that in fact there's a great deal of wool. There's not such a shortage, but people don't think there's a way, and that if people thought there was a way, or at least something that wouldn't break the federal budget, then people would support it. Which in retrospect, I think is actually kind of obvious, because the United States is a distillation of the human spirit of exploration. Mm-hmm. People came here from other places. There's no nation that's more a nation of explorers than the United States. But people need to believe that it's possible, and they don't have to give up like healthcare or something important.
Right.
It's got to be that's important. So I thought, okay, well, then it's not a question of will; it's a question of showing that there's a way. And I started reading quite a bit about rockets to try to understand why they're so freaking expensive. Is this something? Where does the $60 million go for the Delta II? And that's subsequently now Delta II, I think, is $100 million or something, even some crazy number. And Delta II is a relatively small rocket. So if you go to like a really one of the bigger rockets, it's anywhere from $200 to $400 million. So I came to the conclusion that there wasn't really a good reason for rockets to be so expensive, and that they could be a lot less, and even in an expendable format, they could be less, and that if one could make them reusable, like airplanes, then the cost of rocketry would drop dramatically. Cost of space travel would drop dramatically, because the cost of the fuel was maybe anywhere from 0.2 to 0.5% of the cost of the rocket.
Right.
It's kind of like a plane. How much is the cost of the fuel in the plane versus the plane itself? Mm-hmm. It's at least a two order of magnitude difference. But nobody had really been able to make a reusable rocket work. So I thought if we can do that, then that would really be the key breakthrough for space travel.
Right. But you also said that...
So far, we have not succeeded, I should point out.
You've also said that failure was the most likely outcome. Can you talk about failure in that sense and in a broader sense of being an entrepreneur and an innovator? Why is failure so important?
I think failure is bad. I don't think it's good. Mm-hmm. But if something's important enough, then you do it even though the risk of failure is high.
Mm-hmm.
So I think my advice, if somebody wants to start a company, is they should bear in mind that the most likely outcome is that it's not going to work, and they should reconcile themselves to that strong possibility. They should only do it if they feel that they are really compelled to do it.
Right.
Because it's going the way starting a company works is like usually in the beginning, it's the very beginning, it's kind of fun. And then it's really hellish for a number of years.
You talked about chewing glass.
Yeah, there's a friend of mine who's a successful entrepreneur, started actually his career around the same time as I did. And he has a good phrase. His name's Bully. He said, "Yeah, starting a company is like eating glass and staring into the abyss." Mm-hmm. And
you agree with that?
Generally true. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you don't eat the glass, you're not going to be successful.
That's tough medicine.
Tough medicine.
So let's move along. We're going to get down into innovation and motivation shortly, but I want to just go through your whole business career first. So shortly after founding SpaceX, you then got interested in electric vehicles. And I understand you watched the vigils for the death of the EV1. When they were all smashed. Talk about that and why you felt, even after founding SpaceX, I have to get involved with Tesla.
Yeah, as I said, like my interest in electric vehicles goes back a long time goes back 20
right,
plus
the
years.
Dating scene.
Yeah,
right.
Actually, exactly. and in fact, the original reason I came to Silicon Valley was to work on electric vehicle energy storage technology. And I thought that that the big car companies would develop electric cars because obviously the right move. And I thought that was vindicated when General Motors and Toyota announced their General Motors was doing the EV1, the electric vehicle one. Toyota did the electric RAV4, the original one. And they made those announcements and they brought those to market. And I thought, okay, well, this is great. We're going to have electric cars. GM's going to obviously do the EV2 and 3, and then they just keep getting better, and everything would be cool. When California relaxed its regulations on electric cars, GM recalled all of the EV1s and crushed them into little cubes, mm-hmm. Which is seemed kind of nutty. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, the people didn't want their EV1s recalled.
Yeah.
And in fact, they tried court orders to stop the cars from being recalled. They held a candlelit vigil, okay, at the yard where the cars were crushed.
Did you attend that vigil?
No, I did not.
You're moved by it.
Well, certainly. I mean, it's crazy. When is the last time you heard about any company customers holding a candlelit vigil for the demise of that product, mm-hmm. Particularly a GM product? I mean, what bigger wake-up call do you need? It's like, hello, the customers are really upset about this. They would really prefer it if it didn't get recalled. So that kind of blew my mind. So it was like, wow, okay. And then we had the advent of lithium-ion batteries, which really helps, that's one of the key things for making electric cars work. It's still nothing. And so, in 2003, I actually had lunch with one of the other co-founders of the company, J.B. Straubel, who was actually working, I think, on like a hydrogen airplane or something. He mentioned to me T0 car that was done by AC Propulsion. AC Propulsion, I think, consisted of guys, some of whom had actually been on the EV1 program, and they took a gasoline sports car, kind of a kit car, and outfitted it with lithium-ion batteries, sort of consumer-grade cells, and they created a car which is essentially the precursor of the Roadster. And in fact, it had very similar specifications. So sub 4 second 0 to 60 miles an hour, 250 mile range, and also a 2-seater sort of sports car. But it was quite primitive. It didn't have a roof, one thing, at all. In fact, I don't know if it had doors, but it didn't have any safety systems, no airbags. It wasn't homologated, so you couldn't sell it. So in order to sell that car, in order to create a commercial version of the car, something that a manufacturer could produce and sell to people, there was a fair bit of work that was required. But anyway, I kept trying to get AC Propulsion to commercialize the T0. And I said, look, I'll fund the whole effort. Mm-hmm. You really need to do this. And they just sort of refused to do it. They didn't want to do it. They wanted to make, they wanted to make like an electric Scion, which in principle sounds good, except that it would have cost $75,000. And nobody wants to buy a $75,000 Scion. The technology just was not ready. There was just no way to make a good value for money proposition.
What was it that compelled you to say, I have to be CEO here and lead this company? Why not say, I'll help you, JB, get this rolling?
Well, I really didn't want to be CEO of two companies. Mm-hmm. I tried really hard not to be, actually. So AC Propulsion finally said, okay, I actually told AC Propulsion, look, if you're not going to do this, I'm going to create a company to do this. And they said, well, there's some other guys who are also interested in doing that, and you guys should combine efforts and create a company. And that's basically how Tesla came together. And then we had like a lot of drama. Since I was the, you know, I provided like 95% of the money, so I could have been the CEO from day one, but I really, you know, the idea of being CEO of two startups at the same time was not appealing, and shouldn't be appealing, by the way, if anyone's thinking that's a good idea. It's a really terrible idea.
But then, again, you know, going back to your trajectory here, not only did you take on two, you took on three. You had an epiphany at Burning Man, I understand, and decided...
You have to watch epiphanies, Burning Man. Not necessarily what you should pursue.
And you came up with the idea.
Solar is kind of part of the whole sustainable energy thing. So mm-hmm. sustainable energy, you have to have sustainable means of producing and consuming energy. And so even if you have electric cars, you have to have the other side of the equation. Say, how do you produce energy in a sustainable way? And I think solar is the obvious primary means of sustainable energy generation. In fact, the Earth is almost entirely solar powered today. The only reason we're not a frozen ice ball at sort of 3 degrees Kelvin is because of the sun. And the sun is responsible for all precipitation. It's responsible for the vast majority of the ecosystem, apart from sort of chemotrophs at the bottom of the ocean. There's just a tiny amount of energy that people consume to power civilization. It's actually a very tiny amount of energy relative to the amount of energy that the sun sends in our general direction. And so in order to deal with that, we couldn't, in fact, power the entire world with solar power quite easily. This is maybe not super obvious to people. But
so was that the epiphany you had at Burning Man? Was it a
vision? No, I knew that long. I knew that in college.
But what was the key vision that came to you at Burning Man? We all want to imagine you there.
Vision. it was more I wouldn't say it was a particular epiphany. It was more that I was at Burning Man with my cousins, or two of my cousins,
Lyndon and Peter.
Lyndon and Peter Rive, mm-hmm. Who are awesome guys, and they were sort of trying to think, what should they do after their first startup? So they did a company called Everdream, which did large-scale management of computers. So if you've got like 60,000 computers, it's kind of hard to manage them. So they wrote this, they created software that enables companies to do that. And that company actually got sold to Dell.
So they were looking for a new venture and looking for your ideas?
Well, I wouldn't say they're initially looking for my ideas, but I actually was trying to convince them that they should do solar. Because I just thought it was an area that needed people like them, who are really good entrepreneurs. So, and since I was like somewhat overcommitted, I thought...
to say the least.
Yeah. I thought, well, and I said, like, look, if you guys will do a solar company, I'll fund you, you know, provide all the funding and, you know, whatever guidance I can, or help I can provide, I'd do that. And I thought it was really important that there be, you know, good entrepreneurs like them in solar, because it just wasn't doing very well as an industry. So, and I thought people were kind of focusing on they weren't focusing on the right problem. Everybody sort of thought that the panel was the problem, but actually it's a problem, but it's not the most important problem. The panel is somewhat commoditized at this point. So it's right. You know, making standard efficiency solar panels is about as hard as making drywall. It's really easy. In fact, I'd say drywall is probably harder. Mm-hmm. What is a thorny problem is trying to figure out how to get solar on tens of thousands, eventually hundreds of thousands of rooftops.
Right, the logistics part.
Yeah, it's kind of like you got to re-roof millions of buildings. And then figure out how the grid interconnects work, and then manage all those systems. Like, so if you've got hundreds of thousands or maybe millions of systems eventually, you've got to manage all these distributed systems. You have this really complex distributed utility, effectively, which I think actually plays to two of their strengths in creating, their prime strength in creating really scalable software for managing, you know, hundreds of thousands of computers in a distributed fashion. And that's kind of what they did, and it's an awesome job. It was just like I basically would show up at the board meetings to hear what's the good news this time. You know, it's like really, you know, we had like maybe a couple of bad news board meetings. Well, late 2008, there were some bad news board meetings, but for the most part, apart from a few times when the macroeconomic conditions were really terrible, they just did an amazing job with, you know, almost no help from me.
So you've been able to leave it in their good hands.
Yeah, that's, they deserve the vast majority of the credit for the success of that company.
Awesome. So I'd like to move on to innovation and motivation. There's been a lot of talk lately about the fact that innovation is leveling off. We're not making the dramatic increases or improvements in innovation like we did when the plane was invented. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't agree with that. I don't think that's true. I think we've seen... Well, and I'm not sure of what time period that is exactly, but I mean, we've seen huge improvements in the internet and new things. I mean, in the recent years, Twitter and Facebook being pretty huge, when people kind of thought the internet was done. You know, I think that there are some of the things that we're doing, like you know, electric cars are a new thing, I do think there's some pretty significant breakthroughs. I mean, in genomics, we're getting better and better at decoding genomes and being able to write genetics. I think that's going to be a huge, huge area. I think there's likely to be some breakthroughs in artificial intelligence. I suspect we will even see the flying car.
All right. Is that going to be an Elon Musk production?
No.
You're going to let someone else do that?
I think someone else. I think someone else is doing that.
All right. Okay, that's another conversation. Do you feel the government is standing in the way of innovation at all?
Well, sometimes the government. I don't think the government intends to stand in the way of innovation, but sometimes it can overregulate industries to the point where innovation becomes very difficult.
Right.
I mean, in the auto industry used to be a great hotbed of innovation at the beginning of the 20th century, but now there's so many regulations that are intended to protect consumers. I mean, the body of regulation for cars could like fill, you know, this room. It's just crazy how much regulation there is, down to like what the headlamps are supposed to be like, and they even specify some of the elements of the user interface on the dashboard, and some of these are completely anachronistic. Because they're relating back to the days when you had like a little light that would illuminate an image. So like we have to reserve space on the instrument panel of the Model S for where all of the indicators like that a car would have. You know, you've got like these little lights like
check engine or whatever.
Yeah, like all these little things. There's like a whole bunch of them, and we can't have anything else in that space. Like. Well, how about if we have one space and render a different graphic? Like, oh no, because people are expecting to see it in that space. Like, nobody is expecting to see it in that space.
Yeah, so you feel you can't argue with these regulations, you just have to.
Well, you can argue with them, but not with great success. you can actually get these things changed, but it takes ages.
Right.
Like, one of the things we're trying to get is, like, why should you have side mirrors if you can have, say, little video cameras, tiny video cameras, and have them, you know, display an image inside the car. But there are all these regulations saying you have to have side mirrors. And I went and met with the Secretary of Transport, like, can you change this regulation? Still, nothing has happened. That was like 2 years ago. you know.
So you're banging your head against a wall here a little bit.
It's not easy to get these regulations changed.
So talking of government, President Obama is obviously trying to do what he can. If you had 5 minutes with President Obama, what would you advise him for, one, stimulating the economy and entrepreneurship and creating jobs? Is there one thing that if he could successfully get through that would be a big stimulus, do you think?
Well, I think actually, I think the reality of being president is that you're actually like the captain of a very huge ship and have a small rudder. because obviously, if there was a button that a president could push that said economic prosperity, you'd be like, they're hitting that button real fast.
Full steam ahead, yeah.
You could measure the speed of light by how fast they press that button. Because that would be, that's called the, like the re-election button. I'm not sure how much a president can really do, but I'm generally a fan of like minimal government interference in the economy. Like the government should be kind of like the referee, but not the player. And there shouldn't be too many referees. there is an exception, which is when there's an unpriced externality, such as the CO2 capacity of the oceans and atmosphere. Right. So when you have an unpriced externality, then the normal market mechanisms do not work, and then it's government's role to intervene in a way that's sensible. And the best way to intervene is to assign a proper price to whatever the common good is that's being consumed.
So you're saying there should be a tax on gas?
There should be a tax on carbon. You know, if the bad thing is carbon accumulation in the atmosphere, then there needs to be a tax on that. And then we can, that will, and then you can get rid of all subsidies and all everything else. And it seems like logical that you should tax things that are most likely to be bad rather than, you know, like that's why we tax cigarettes and alcohol. Because those are probably bad for you. Certainly cigarettes are. So you want to err on the side of taxing things that are probably bad and not tax things that are good. Given that there is a need to gather tax for the, to pay for the federal government, we should shift the tax burden to bad things and then adjust that tax of that bad thing according to whatever is going to result in the behavior that we think is beneficial for the future. I mean, I think currently what we're doing right now, which is mining and burning trillions of tons of hydrocarbons that used to be buried very deep underground, and now we're sticking them in the atmosphere and running this crazy chemical experiment on the atmosphere. And then you've got the oil and gas companies, which have ungodly amounts of money. And you can't expect them to just roll over and die. Like, they don't do that. Actually, what they much prefer to do is spend enormous amounts of money lobbying and running bogus ad campaigns and that kind of thing to preserve their situation. Mm. It's a lot like tobacco companies in the old days. I mean, they used to run these ads with doctors, like a guy with a doctor, pretending he's a doctor, essentially implying that smoking is good for you.
Right.
And like having pregnant mothers on ads smoking.
Do you have a message for the climate change skeptics and the big oil people?
Well, as far as climate change skeptic, I mean, like I'm, you know, I believe in the scientific method, and one should have a healthy skepticism of things in general. And if you approach things from a scientific standpoint, you always look at things probabilistically, not definitively. And so I think a lot of times, if somebody's a skeptic in the science community, what they're really saying is that they're not sure that it's 100% certain that this is the case. But that's not the point. The point is to look at it from the other side. See, what do you think the percentage chance is of this being catastrophic for some meaningful percentage of the Earth's population? Is it greater than 1%? Is it even 1%? If it is even 1%, why are we running this experiment?
Right, because you called it a Russian roulette. We're playing Russian roulette with the atmosphere.
We're playing Russian roulette, and then as each year goes by, we're loading more rounds in the chamber. Mm. it's not wise.